Welcome to My First Dungeon, the tabletop role-playing podcast where we help new game masters get started quickly and with confidence. Our goal is to guide you towards the very best resources and to introduce you to some of the most interesting thinkers and creators in the TTRPG space that can help you make your home games even better. While I imagine most of this audience is interested in playing RPGs with their friends, I'm guessing there is a certain percentage out there who, like myself, aspire to create RPG shows for others to enjoy as well. But building a game for an audience requires a whole different set of skills than just running one for your friends, and that's why I've brought in an expert on this very topic. He is a comedian, a writer, a performer, and the producer of the award-winning and wildly popular narrative play podcasts, Rude Tales of Magic, Fun City, and Oh These, Those Stars of Space, where he also plays such characters as Legs Loveless and Baron Baudelaire. If you by some chance don't already know who I'm talking about, I am about to tell you. Are you ready? Have I gone on long enough? Okay, I'll just tell you, it's Taylor Moore!
I was giving you the stretch sign. More, longer!
You want more?
More,
you want more?
More praise!
Okay. Who's ready? I've written, this is all the things I wrote.
Say his parents definitely understand his job.
His parents are super supportive. You wouldn't believe how supportive they are and how understanding they are about what exactly it is. They ask every time they see him, what kind of bit rates are you using? Tell us about your bit rates. Sam, what's that say? You use an MP3 or .wav? Is it WAV or WAVE? I've been hearing the kids talk about it.
I would forgive them for saying WAV. I think I would let Dad off with the WAV.
Taylor, how's it going? It's great to see you.
It's so nice to meet you. Thanks for having me on, Brian.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming. I'm really excited about this. I love what you and the entire team at Fortunate Horse do. I think all your shows are fantastic. I was telling you before we started, I've been recently binging Oh These, the Stars of Space. I think it's fantastic, along with all the shows, but that one's been really in my craw recently.
That's where we want to be.
That's right where you want to be. You want to be right in the craw, yeah. Baby.
The target demo? Crawl.
Crawl. Before we kind of get into the meat of it, can you tell me, how did you first get into tabletop role-playing games, RPGs, stuff like that?
Oh my God. I grew up in the woods in West Alabama, a place called Fayette County, Fayette and Pickens County. And one day, I mean, I don't know what the inciting incident was, but somehow one of the guys that lived on my street when I was a freshman in high school, his older brother was like a classic. I mean, could have been cast in Freaks and Geeks. Okay. Like, it was the mid-90s, and he still looked like an older brother someone would have had in 1975. Like, the big glasses that are now becoming hip again,
right?
But were very nerdy for, like, 30 years, you know? And, like, tight jeans, a ponytail, a tool on his wallet, like, a tool on his belt, mm-hmm. and, like, you know, definitely going to be an IT guy. And I was friends with his little brother. And I'm going to show you guys how to play Dungeons and Dragons. And I mean, you talk about love at first sight. But then, so we played a little bit in high school and then I didn't play again. And then I rediscovered it in college and then didn't play it for a long, long time. Because, you know, this is before, I feel like the Renaissance of it all has happened while I was working my last office job, which was at Kickstarter. And so surrounded by it and was like, this is a great chance to try it again. So I did. And I haven't stopped since.
Hell yeah. What was there? Was there a moment in like seeing all the Kickstarter things happening? Was there a moment where it's just like, ping? Oh, right. I did love this. I got to do this again.
Was there? I mean, there was a yes. So the tabletop role playing world was just blowing up on Kickstarter. It turns out there was just a giant pile of oily rags laying around, and all you needed to ignite it was like fundraising outside the big publishers world, you know, and that's all it took. And so the money was just like flying everywhere and the numbers were going wild just through the roof. And a lot of people in the company had never played anything like that before. So the guy who was Luke Crane, the guy who was in charge of games, said, okay, I'm going to just run some D&D games to like show everybody what this thing that is now paying all your paychecks is. And he said he was going to run some like classic Redbox first edition D&D, the mold vase stuff, the vintage Dungeons and Dragons. And I was like, I know how to do that. And I just started working here. This is going to be a great way to meet people. So I started a level one D&D basic game with two of the company's founders. Oh, and yeah. We played together for years. That game went on for, like, I'm not kidding, 5 years.
That's especially for like a first edition game. Those are tough.
That was brutal. I think I was only like level four when we, after 5 years, you know.
With the same character, or did you go through a couple?
Yes. No, maybe no. I survived.
That's impressive.
Well, you know, I had a little bit of experience. And so, you know, I was.
I don't know. First edition experience might not mean shit.
That's true. That game is bonkers. Yeah. But that was also so cool. Like, and being exposed to that and being exposed to all like the classic dungeon crawl stuff that was being published and all the histories and stuff that was also coming out about like the early creation of D&D. I got really into like the history of it and the like all the theory behind it and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And so then I started playing again, and then, you know, I started another game and I started DMing another game and I wrote all this stuff and all this stuff.
I absolutely know that world. You start one, it's like, oh, now I'm a DM over here. Oh, and all of a sudden, like 5 out of 7 nights are D&D DMing nights.
And the Kickstarter office had this, they built this new big building in Greenpoint in Brooklyn, this old abandoned warehouse. We bought it and it was just a big cube full of rats and water. And they built this like very comfortable, modern, cool office in there. And one of the rooms was just like a giant library of actual books. They bought a library collection from a dead publisher, some guy in like Pittsburgh that died, and they bought his entire library of like all the books and just stuffed them in there so it looked cool. And there was a like a surreally large wooden table, like straight out of Game of Thrones, like bang in the middle of this room. And you turn the lights off. One of the walls was just all glass, like looking into this like garden courtyard. You turn the lights off, you turn the lamps on. You have never played in a better place. And it was every night. And it was in a room full, it was in an office full of nerds. And had, you know, so friends would come in and play. It was just every night somebody was playing in there. It was a really cool time to roll dice. Yeah.
For anyone who's listening right now who doesn't know what Rude Tales, Fun City, and Odysseus of Stars of Space are, can you give us just like a quick download on what these shows are?
Yes. Our little production company is called Fortune Horse. We publish 3 shows. Fun City, which is a like Shadowrun-based political social commentary, cyberpunk, New York City, 100 years in the future. There's hackers. There's also magic. Uh-oh, didn't see that coming, did you? Or did you? You think you know it? You don't, baby. Fun City. Which also, we also did like a big campaign on Fun City of this, during like when the pandemic first came, we like a lot of shows did, we sort of experimented and tried some other stuff. And one of the things we tried was this really cool, like surreal, weirdo, far future, million years in the future, space weirdness sci-fi game called Stillfleet. And we did a whole campaign of that, and that was, people loved it. So if you go on to Fun City, you can listen to the fun cyberpunk stuff or the weirdo space opera stuff. Both a blast. And then there's Rude Tales of Magic, which is I never know how to describe
it's a tough one.
It's a weird one. Yeah, I mean, what can I tell you? Like, fantasy endangered in a fantasy world where passion and mystery lurk around every corner. I don't know how better to describe it than that. It's this sort of surreal and bonkers road adventure story. It's very funny. I don't know what to tell you.
Extremely funny and extremely rude.
Yeah, it's pretty rude. And then, of course, Odysseus of Stars of Space, which is straight up an episodic, wild Star Trek pastiche. And that's not me clapping for myself. I'm dusting off my hands because that one is easy to explain.
And you describe these shows, and these shows are not built as actual play shows as most people might know. They're built as what you guys are calling narrative play shows. Can you tell me a little bit about the difference there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and this is difficult because all like fiction shows that play a game on them or that use a game to tell the story are categorized as actual play shows. And that sucks because that name does not really tell you what is going on.
Right.
But, you know, the category grew, of course, from people just playing games on camera and mic, both in podcast and on video. So it makes sense. But yeah, like none of these games are extremely tied to the rules. And all three of the shows, to different degrees, focus more on character interaction and narrative momentum than getting lost in the weeds of rules and game stuff.
It is definitely a spectrum. And just to say actual play is such a big category. Like, it may have started as one thing and now it's expanded into such things as, you know, on one end of like the far narrative play is like Mission to Zix.
That's controversial. I get in the occasional argument with my friends on that show with Jeremy Bent. Although I am willing to physically fight the entire cast if they hear this. Fucking come get it.
What, one at a time or just all together?
I could probably take them all together.
Do you know what the battlefield would be? Is there like, Jeremy's battlefield? Did they just pick the battlefield?
He's like 8 feet tall. He could probably.
Oh yeah,
gotta get in close to that guy. You gotta get in close to Jeremy. No, so they are just an improvised show,
right?
But I would argue that because I was in some of the same classes as them, that they are actually the game they are playing is long form improvisation.
Oh yeah, I mean, long form improv is built around the idea of the game of a scene. It's you don't happen to have dice.
Exactly. So yeah, the game doesn't have dice, but it does have rules of thumb and best practices and certain techniques that they use. So, but they would say they're not playing a game. But, you know, I mean, then we're getting into the philosophy of what makes a game and what is a game. And I don't know.
Right.
I'm just a guy.
Yeah, who knows? And then, I mean, on the far end of the like true actual play shows are things like Critical Role or like streaming shows where you see every instance that happens at the table, regardless of whether that could be a shopping episode where you're just watching people spend gold that they made. Or it could be the epic narrative that you're probably really there for. I know, you know, don't get me wrong, I love a shopping episode as much as everybody, but you're usually shooting for the narrative arc.
Yeah, but people love the actual play stuff. And people love, I have watched actual play streams of games that I want to understand.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, this game looks cool. Before I pitch me running it for someone, let me go watch James D'Amato play it. You know, on the one shot video and just like see how it goes, you know, how do they do it? How do they play it? I love actual play stuff, but that's the thing, right? It's like they're all great. I feel like what has happened is a bunch of us tabletop nerds have stumbled into this. Here's the thing. So D&D, like, which gave birth to what we call tabletop role playing games, right? You know, I mean, like, we don't have to like it, but that's the truth. But it didn't really, right? Because like the wargaming stuff pre-existed. But it was like they saw what was cool about the wargaming and they experimented with it and like took parts away and added parts. The individual perspective, the concept of leveling up and all these different things, the turn-based, you know, all these things, how it works. And they stumbled across this, like, not a secret formula, but it's the way anything is invented or made. It's like someone realizes these pieces laying around can fit together this new way. And suddenly it's not sodium, it's not chloride, it's table salt, and that's a whole new thing. All of a sudden, salad tastes good. You know, sodium will kill you. Table salt, oh wow, potatoes are fun.
Salad was bad for so long, and then finally we figured out salad.
So what, fucking salt? People, you know, like, God, you know, people just say worth your weight in salt. Right? Isn't that a phrase? That's a phrase. Worth your salt, whatever. It rules. But it's like you figure these new things can come out. And so people are playing these tabletop role-playing games. And then, I don't know, was a camera on a tripod and it fell over like in Flubber, like everything just sort of like there was an accident in the lab and a camera someone left on like fell over and caught someone DMing and they see it and they're like, wait a minute, you know, enhance. This is an entirely new medium of entertainment production, which is really what it is. I mean, that's what it is, I think. What the streamer, the tabletop world has stumbled upon is a really cool new way to produce serial storytelling. Right. And it doesn't really have anything to do with D&D. Like the success that's been wrapped up in all of it now is sort of piggybacking on the pre-existing interest and market for Dungeons and Dragons mostly and other tabletop role-playing games. But like the fundamental principles could be applied in any genre at all. You don't need fantasy. You don't even need adventure or anything like that.
And a lot of the indie games are really trying to shed those, you know, stereotypes or those like tropes as much as possible, and are doing more and more interesting and different things that haven't been as explicitly explored in things like, you know, D&D, Call of Cthulhu, stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, like this is what's funny is, you know, I follow the tabletop social media discourse sphere is like a chattering cloud of distraction demons that live between the worlds, and heaven forbid you walk through a portal the wrong way because they will eat you alive like the goddamn Langoliers. It's an atrocious place to be, but it's like people are acting like this is a big deal. It's not. All mediums and art forms go through this process. Mm-hmm. It always happens. You know, the Western, you know, I just watched some episodes of this Boba Fett show the other day.
Yeah.
That is a straight up Western serial, but it looks very different from the Western serials that were coming out in the late 50s, right?
Right. It's not Have Gun, Will Travel. It's a whole other thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's just Paladin with lasers, sort of. But it's like, yeah, like mediums, genres, and things like that naturally variate. I mean, it's all the evolutionary process, right? It's like replication, variation, selection. That's what you need, and everything evolves from that. But here's the thing. I'm so glad you brought up the narrative and actual play distinction, because I think that calling all of this actual play is preventing a lot of that evolution of the genre and of the medium.
Right.
Because it commits you, the producer, and it commits the listener to an idea that what you're about to witness is people playing a game, which in the case of Rude Tales of Magic, it's like saying, hey, let's go watch someone use a word processor and you show them an episode of The X-Files. Yes, technically, that was written in a word processor, and you are watching someone perform the results of what that word processor did. But that is an insane way to describe it. Yes. That is a wild way to describe it. And so especially on Rude Tales, we see the game, which is almost like the fact that we call it Dungeons and Dragons is like, that's like calling Australia an island. Like, right. Technically, again, sure. Sort of true, but it's not really, you're not describing it the way people think of it. You know, like, right. We use so little of the actual D&D rules that really we call it D&D just because it communicates what's necessary about some of the stuff to some of the people. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so it's like we use the game as a production method. So we sit down, we are going to make a show. We're going to make a good show. We're going to have a good time doing it. A tabletop role-playing game is just one of the tools that we use to do that. Same as microphones, copper wire, or electricity, period. Mm-hmm. So I would say if you want to know how to play Dungeons and Dragons 5th edition, it might be a bad idea to base it off Rude Tales of Magic. We're not actually, you know, are we playing the game? I don't know. My favorite rule in Dungeons and Dragons is the first paragraph of the Dungeon Master's Guide, where it's like, hey, just have a good time out there.
And honestly, like, that is the tagline of the show. If you're having fun, you're already doing it right.
Yeah. Great. Congrats. Good job.
You nailed it. 10 out of 10. You did it right.
There's a great episode of, I'll never forget this. Okay, remember the show Growing Pains?
Yeah.
Do you remember this?
Yeah. Right.
There's an episode, so Kirk Cameron plays, what was his name? Mike. His name was Mike, and he's like a Bart Simpson sort of teenager, like, I'm not too crazy about rules, but I'm charming and everybody likes me. And so he's going to cheat on a test. There's a test coming up, and he's going to cheat on it. So what he does is he takes a pair of sneakers, and he writes all the stuff that's going to be on the test on the bottom of the shoes. Mm-hmm. And then what his plan is that when the test comes, he's just going to cross his legs and read the bottom of his shoes, and he'll have all the information. Well, I think something goes wrong with his shoes, or but he has to do it again. So he has to recopy everything onto the shoes. And then he goes in to take the test, and he realizes that having copied all the information out by longhand, he has now learned the information of the test. And he no longer needs to cheat. He has tricked himself into studying, which is a long way of saying that sometimes we get sort of like caught up in the superficial idea of what we are supposed to do. Mm-hmm. We fail to recognize what we are actually doing, like, in the moment. outside of like the prescribed rituals of what we think we're supposed to be doing. And there's a lot of times when I'm DMing my own games, this happens of like, we're having fun. And then someone asks me a question. I'm like, let me find the rule for that. Like an idiot. Like, you are going to stop the momentum of this scene to look up how three quarters cover works, you ass.
Just make it up. It's the first rule in the book.
Have fun. Have fucking fun, you asshole. Just go with it. Stop. It's a cargo cult. It's like building earphones out of coconuts. It's like, no, stop. That's not how the mechanics of that actually work. You're already having a good time. Give yourself a pat on the back and don't fuck it up.
And I think there is something to be said about, you know, when we have a category so broad as actual play that doesn't accurately describe everything within it, the greatest source of like any kind of tension you'll ever experience is a mismatch of expectation. And that's true in in work and relationships, in friendships, whatever, because you're coming in with an expectation of, oh, I'm going to see people play a game. And all of a sudden you don't see them quote unquote play that game or play the game as you anticipated. All of a sudden, it's like going into a movie thinking it's a comedy, but realizing it's a drama. It's like, God. Like, I'm sure this is a good movie, but that wasn't what I was in for. I was ready to laugh, and now I've got to cry. I'm not in a cry mood.
Yeah, I totally agree. Or like you sign up for a painting class, and you get there, and you're painting a barn. You know what I mean? Like putting red paint on a barn. It's like, well, we're gonna do a great job of painting this barn. It's like, that's not what I thought this was.
I was really hoping to, you know, experiment with my art form. And this is like, day labor.
Whose fault is that? It's the person that wrote the class description in the program. You shouldn't just call everything with a brush and paint painting.
That's a fun way to put it.
You know, that is, you have fucked up someone's good time because you have failed to distinguish in your nomenclature. And I think that's what we're doing by calling it all actual play. So what do I mean when I say narrative play? So I've talked about this online and people have gotten mad at me because they think I am saying that people that include all the rule discussion and rules in their show are not telling a story. That is not what I am saying. Here's how to tell if you're running an actual play or narrative play show, mm-hmm. right? Or here's, if you want to run a show, you're not quite sure what you want to do. Think about these things. How much post-production editing are you going to be doing on the show? I think the more post you put into it, the greater the chances you're doing a narrative play, especially if we're talking about editing out things recorded at the table. Mm-hmm. This is why most live streaming is actual play, because it's not edited, it's live, you see it all there. Though hypothetically, I would even say that like the Rude Tales live shows are live narrative play. You can do it, it can be done,
right.
But it requires a much more specialized skill set that is someone who has probably paid thousands of dollars to be taken in by a coastal big city elite improv school that were still operating 4 years ago.
Oh man, we can get deep into that dive
Well, I mean, here's the thing is like, there's an enormous overlap in the skill set of good tabletop role playing and improvisation. You could talk about how dorky those things are and how lame it all is, because mm-hmm. here's the thing, we've all been dragged to bad improv shows. Or, you know, if you live in a big city, there's and you're in like the creative or the comedy or whatever world or the content, whatever media world, chances are you've been taken or invited to someone's improv class and a lot of a show, and a lot of them are really bad. So it gets a bad rap. But the thing is just that most of everything is shit. But the skill set you learn in doing it is extremely applicable.
And the thing is, like, I don't want anyone to listen to this and take away from it, the only way I can start a good show is by learning improv. All that improv is because it's so similar and crosses over so much. It's essentially, hey, I've gotten months, weeks, years of practice with a teacher who's saying, like, here's how you do it better. That happens to translate very well to the type of show you're trying to make.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's worse ways to practice.
Yeah.
You know, there's definitely worse ways to practice. I'm friends with Brendan Mulligan, the DM at Dementia 20. That guy, I met him through doing improv in New York. Mm-hmm. And he definitely was a better improviser, having done tabletop and LARPing stuff for decades before he started doing improv shows. 100%. The role play, it's almost the same thing, really.
Right.
So narrative play, actual play. The more you are cutting from your show, the higher the chances you're going to do narrative play. The less rules you have, higher chances you're focusing on narrative play. And here's a big one. if you're adding content to the show, if you are adding copy, if you're adding really like big emotionally, not just music beds, but I mean like music cues, because anybody can put some music under dialogue. I'm talking about like, we're talking about like John Williams working with George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. Like the music is part of the experience, that level. Listen, we all aspire to that, but I'm just saying like, you're trying to manipulate the audience's emotion with post-production.
Right.
The closer you get into narrative play. Like all those things sort of nudge you one direction on a spectrum. And neither end of the spectrum is better than the other. But having a name for things that focus, they're willing to edit and produce things in a way that is focusing on an emotional journey and narrative momentum, right? That's a big deal. So like an actual play show, let's just say it's playing Rules as Written, right? Let's just say it's a hardcore Rules as Written show. You can have dynamic performances from the DM and the cast. You can have great production, video, audio, whatever. Big music cues, incredibly well-produced Foley and all these things. But like at some point, something is going to happen. Someone is going to make a move that sucks narratively. Now, here's the thing. Improv teaches you this, and I think good DMs know this. There's almost no such thing as a bad move that a player can make, right?
Yeah.
In improv, you call it justification. So, and Branson Reese, who's the DM of Rude Tales, is extremely good at this. A lot of the great DMs, Brendan Mulligan, very, very good at this. No matter what the players do, you can make it look important and smart and good, right? But that power has limits. Not every move can, not, you can't polish every turd. So every, even an actual play show where you're not cutting very much and you're doing the rules as written, someone might make a move and you're like, look, hey, we've been doing this show for 3 years. We've done 100 episodes. Maybe you should put the Sapphire of Kroton in the Pillar of Vortex that's going to kill the evil wizard. You're right there by it. Come on, dude. Just fucking do it. Can we go back and you just do the thing that we've been building up to do for, you know, listen, this is not a great example, but you understand what I'm saying.
If you're building towards a narrative thing and all of a sudden you do the like kind of shitty D&D player thing that everyone does from time to time of like, you know, I'm not going to beat the dragon. Let's go farm some sheep or whatever. It's like, let's do the thing that we want to do.
Or even like this, and we've had this happen on Rude Tales. There's a mistake. Like someone leave that in as punishment.
Oh, I'm keeping it.
In a pivotal climactic moment within an arc, someone mishears someone else. And then they think something else is going on. And so you have two improvisers, two players at the table that are trying to build a story with completely different assumptions about what's going on in the scene. And it breaks.
Right.
Right. Like, it's like, wait, fuck, the last 10 minutes made no sense because I thought you said this. Like, no, I said a word that sounded like that. And like, you know, so what do you do in an actual play show? Well,
that's what happened. That's what actually happened.
In a narrative show, no fucking way you leave that in. No fucking way. I don't think so. Far into the narrative spectrum. No way that gets cut because a narrative show focuses way more on emotional and narrative momentum for the listener than a high fidelity representation of what happens at a table, no matter how good that table is, you know, and it's just different considerations.
Another way to kind of look at this is, you know, even taking away the idea of editing or something, the further the experience of the listener gets from the experience of the player, the closer you get to narrative play.
Absolutely. Because you might add things in. So something we do at Rude Tales, you know, all DMs have their style. And I would say that Branson, one of his greatest strengths as a DM is characters and relationships and dialogue and role play. I mean, a real savant at it. You heard it here first. He's never done any hard work. He doesn't practice. He was born with it. And therefore, yes.
This is pure like Warlock a Mozart, bullshit.
Very talented, but doesn't understand what he's doing and kind of a child or a fool at play in the fields of the Lord. And you can tell him I said it.
That's going to be the clip I use for the promo, right?
Please
there.
Please let this be the beef that destroys us. When he goes into a scene, he thinks characters. Like, how do I get them to this character? What's his character doing? But when we're building an audio drama, we're building an audio narrative. The thing about audio fiction, audio narrative, it's extremely visual. You have to tell people. And, you know, prose is the same way, you know, like human beings are just so visual. Any non-visual art, I think, has to make, except for music, baby, music, the queen of all the arts. But when you're telling a story, people need to know what to imagine. So, you know, This American Life published a guide to how to do what they do a long time. This is like late 90s or early aughts, I think. It was just called like radio, a how-to guide. I would recommend if anyone wants to make like a serious show like this, you can pick up a copy. I think it's only a few bucks. You can also find free versions online. And I recommend reading it.
I'll post them in the show notes.
All the tech stuff is like, here's how to cut tape with a cassette. Like, it's like old tech. But the principles of like, here's how to interview a subject. Here's how to write descriptive prose for audio. That shit's gold. And one of the things they talk about is location. That when someone from This American Life goes out and interviews a subject, the questions you should be asking them are, where were you standing when that happened? What time of day was it? What season was it?
Sure.
Like, if you were in the kitchen, were you cooking? What were you cooking? You know, like, and all that is to get information to physically place the listener in this giant, like spherical theater of the imagination.
Right.
And one thing that we do on Rue Tales is we go back and in the post-production, we'll go back and we'll create some new descriptive copy. That's all, you know, that's all it takes, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, so what does this place smell like? What does it look like? If I'm creating the narrative of this in my mind, if I'm going on the journey with the show, what do I want to see? We want to tell the listener, well, it's dark, it's wet. It's a giant cavern, but there's a waterfall. So there's this constant rushing sound, boom. And that's a good audio hook I can use. Bring up the waterfall as the waterfall is mentioned. We're building that theater of the mind and all these sensory things. So all that is to say is if you're adding all these like sensory details or plot corrections or a little bit of foreshadowing in post where the players can't hear it, that ain't actual play, baby. That is not actual play, because in actual play, part of what you're watching is the interplay of the information asymmetry between the dungeon master and the players.
Yes.
Are they asking the right questions? What did the dungeon master, you know, did she drop like a clue that the listener heard, but not the players? Oh, that's interesting stuff. And we can do that too in narrative. But in an actual play, I think it would be unfair to the audience and the players if there's more description and information put in the show after. Whereas with Rude Tales, that's not our consideration. Our consideration is like manipulating the emotions of the listener. we are there to achieve catharsis.
But that's also something that you guys decided in the like pre-production phase when you were kind of coming up with the show.
Oh, absolutely. And it's 100% inspired by Balance and Griffin, the way Griffin McElroy DM'd the Balance arc. I remember faking a sick day. Mm-hmm. From work, I had saved up the last four episodes of the Balance arc.
Oh, man.
I was like, listening to these back to back. I called in sick, took the day off work, and just laid on my bed and listened to them. And it was like, I don't know. Sometimes you, if you're lucky in life, sometimes like a work of art will just punch you in the fucking face. Yep. And there's a lot of ways that art can do that. And I think like listening to, especially the back half of the Balance arc, it really blew my mind, because as you're listening to Balance, you're hearing Griffin really mostly because he was producing it, he was editing it, scoring it, and DMing it. Mm-hmm. So while the brothers, the McElroys act as a collective, I really feel like the Balance arc, what made it so great to me was I was watching someone realize while they were creating a new kind of entertainment that they were creating a new kind of entertainment.
Balance arc was the first like D&D content I really listened to. I think I tried Critical Role, but I like couldn't quite get in. It was, you know, the first couple of episodes sound bad. I just couldn't quite get into it, but Balance was great. And there are a few moments that I can very distinctly remember where exactly I was when I heard it.
Yep.
And one of them was the first time a couple episodes in when Griffin adds in like original music for like an outro scene that is very specifically designed to manipulate the emotions of the listener. And I remember I was on 23rd Street. I know exactly where I was because I like literally I was walking with one experience in my head of like an actual play show kind of. And then all of a sudden it hit and I was like, oh, this is becoming something new.
Yes, it's becoming and it's working.
Mm-hmm.
And like that process of like, oh, this guy is like realizing that he's in a box and just systematically like, he's got an X-Acto knife and he's just like cutting holes in the box. And then eventually there's no more box. And it's just, you know, he invents entirely new systems of rules and play mm-hmm. for the last few episodes, last handful of episodes of Balance. And that was when I was like, oh, and it just blew my mind open. This like the principles of tabletop role playing game combined with the principles and the economies of scale of audio post-production.
Mm-hmm.
And add on to that, if you can find a cast of people who are good at improvising and
yeah.
they like each other, you
which
know,
are two very difficult things to put together.
Yes, that's the thing. Like, say what you will about the McElroys, but like they achieved something really remarkable there of like all the ingredients coming into the place at the same. Now, listen, of course, there were other actual play shows. Mm-hmm. There might have been other narrative play shows that I'm not entirely aware of. And of course, there are improvised fictional and written fictional series and all that stuff. But they, I think, got, it's like you're making chili. They got just enough meat, just enough cumin, just enough, like they figured out the ratio of ingredients to where it became something new.
Yes.
You know, and like that, that back half of Balance really was like, oh shit, you are witnessing the creation of like a new mode of telling stories, which sounds so fucking pretentious, but God damn it, I'm
honestly,
right.
Like,
I'm right, you know, motherfuckers.
To be fair,
me.
I absolutely agree that you're right. And I think, you know, there is an aspect of this show in particular where, you know, in episode 3 of most of our seasons, we talk back about how we could have made a game better. And like, yeah. when you take a step back, it's like, we're talking about how to play make-believe better. It's like, there is an aspect of that that is absurd, but it's what we want to do. It's what we love. It's what we care about. But there is an aspect of that first Balance arc because they were in the bubble of actual play. I know there mm-hmm. is a portion of people, wrongly so, who start to not like the end of the Balance arc because it gets away from that yeah. crunchy D&D because
course.
It was becoming a new thing and we didn't have the vocabulary with which to describe it.
Oh, the old hates the new every time, because the old, like things that are successful create a world of vocabulary and practices around themselves. Right. Like in the same, like it all goes back to ecology for me. Like, species will change the environment to suit them, and the environment will change species to suit the environment. And all these systems are acting as pressures on each other, but then something fantastically new happens. Something new is born, and it doesn't quite fit in the world yet. You know, it's like there's friction there. And part of that friction is like people going online to say, oh, railroading, you idiot.
but with that, because there is absolutely a portion of any of these populations that is kind of malicious with this intent. I think
oh, sure.
a good portion of it is that mismatch of expectations creating
yes.
that tension. Like you're going in expecting this, you're getting this.
Yes.
Even if the thing you're getting is as amazing as the Balance arc, if you go in thinking it is Critical Role, you're going to be disappointed or at least
of course.
Have
I signed up for a painting class and now we're painting a barn.
Exactly.
It is a failure of communication, but that, you know, that always happens. You know, so but I hope that was how long ago? That was years and years and years ago. Was yeah. it 5, 6 years? How long ago was that? How long ago Balance did? How long ago that, Brian? How long?
It's gotta be. Gotta be a good like four or five years ago.
That
I
was
think,
the
you
Obama
know?
Years. You know, like oh, come
it
on.
Was a simpler time back then. I gotta tell you.
No, buddy, was it a simpler time?
Maybe not simpler. It was a different time. I don't know yeah. if it was better. It was a time.
So it is time for everybody to grow the fuck up and realize that there's a lot more you can do with improvisational. Fiction guided, right? Because we guided by game-like principles, then actual play stuff, which is great, but we got to let the world be more. And so I think narrative play is I'm not married to the phrase, but like we need to start thinking of this as not reproducing what you can do at home at your table, but using those principles as a new way to make fun shows and have fun with
right.
friends.
And it is like everyone who listens to any kind of actual play, narrative play show, or any kind of podcast, you've been exposed to stories of any form for your entire life more than any other like time in history. Like we watch so much TV, listen to so many podcasts, read so many books. We know, even if we can't describe it, we know what narrative structure is. We know what arcs are. We know how you're supposed to feel at the beginning of a story and at the end of a story. Actual play can certainly do that, but there are lots of times in actual play shows that go against that structure to a mm-hmm. way that feels not great, or it doesn't match expectations. Narrative play is just trying to better fit that structure, which isn't inherent to a tabletop role-playing game where you're fucking around with your friends.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah. You know, and that's the thing. Like if you, it's so strange because it's like, if you're having fun, you're doing it right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, think about it like this. So I've always said that like D&D and all of its spawn, there are like, I am sincerely sorry that like the way communication works means I'm going to do what I'm about to do, but I am going to use Dungeons and Dragons as a sort of ur name for all of its, you know, category that it's created.
And
so
we just lost 25% of the listenership
I know. They're going to put me on the Golgotha after this. But I understand I'm just doing it for quickness. There are three, to my mind, there are three like mega categories of pleasure. And like that, the reason that that game and those games are successful and what makes them different is how much of each of that category they play to. So the three categories are number one, the fiction. Mm-hmm. And that includes like how like cool images produced by the world building, and the just human pleasure we derive from telling stories and being told stories, right? From hearing a good story, from telling a good story, and all the cool images and characters and stuff, like the fiction.
Sure.
The second one is the puzzle. You get the map out, you draw all the things, you know that like Ray of Frost has this range, and your turn is coming up in three turns, but the person before you, they're giving you that look, they're gonna ready a fucking action to help you. So if you move just this number of spaces, and you save your one reaction for this round, like, if you play it right, it's like a Rubik's Cube, or a crossword puzzle, or anything like that.
Right.
You know, a lot of human beings love to have those things click into place. I solved the fucking puzzle. I hit him. I killed the fucking ogre. Like, you know, when you're playing on the grid and things like that, and there's elements of story too that can work as a puzzle. The game itself, the battle aspect of the game can be a puzzle. Other games have aspects of puzzling that has nothing to do with battle, right? Mm-hmm. But we love to get that 5-letter word in the Wordle. We love to finish the Sunday crossword. We love to hear that last turn of the Rubik's Cube click into place. It's the same thing with a really well done bit of gaming puzzle. The third category is all those other things are socially determined, right? Mm-hmm. Human beings, just most of us, social creatures, we love talking with people, negotiating with people, being around, having a good time with friends. You know, fuck me, put me on Golgotha if you want, but I'm saying most people love to have a good time with friends. And
there's another 25% of our audience that just left.
But you could take these games and then you can mix and match the amounts of both. So even if you could take the fun with friends aspect and take it to, like, pull that slider down to zero, and you get like maybe a cool journaling game. Mm-hmm. Right. Or you can pull the puzzle aspect all the way down to zero. And then you've got, you know, I mean, like, you can imagine, like, right, if you know,
it's kind of like an Animal Crossing almost, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's like there is no puzzle aspect. Like, it's just all it is you're telling story with friends. It's a collaborative storytelling game. Right. There's a lot of games like that. And you can move these sliders anyway, you know, and look, you can even take the story slider all the way down and, you know, just like play one level of Gloomhaven.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, you're working with friends to solve this battle puzzle. There's almost no narrative involved in that at all. Apologies to the writers of the great copy for Gloomhaven. But, you know, I mean, it's just, or chess. I mean, you could even say that that's like kind of what chess is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so you move these sliders around, you get all these different games. And the same way you can generate different games like that, you can generate different shows with the same principles. And Rude Tales of Magic is just, well, we don't do a lot of the puzzling stuff, shit. You know, that's all it is. That's all it is just playing with the ingredient amount.
There are so many different types of things that can fit in this category. I do want to take a step back and look at some like concrete stuff that a listener can take away. If you are listening to this and you want to create a type of show,
yeah,
let's kind of go through you and me, because, you know, I make more of a what I would call like an enhanced actual play. It's actual play, but I do a lot of like I manipulate the emotions with music cues and things, but I generally don't add in copy afterwards. So it's actual play plus. And you are doing, you know, hard like narrative play. So let's go through the pre-production, production, and post-production for each of our shows and kind of show what that spectrum can look like.
Oh boy, yeah.
So when you guys started Rude Tales or Fun City or These Are Swords of Space, what considerations did you take into account when you were prepping the game and prepping, you know, the production process that you wouldn't put in place in like a home game? What are some considerations that people might not be thinking of if they're trying to make a narrative play show?
Oh boy, what a great question. And that's a great way to get away from like a bunch of bullshit, pretentious like theory stuff and into the nitty gritty of producing these shows.
Oh no, don't get me wrong. I'm going to leave in most of because I love it. I think this is a conversation that I want to see put out in the world, because I think defining this spectrum a little bit more will help hopefully silence some of that, you know, social media squat. I mean, it won't, but, you know, at least give someone some context.
Like, real quick aside, last little bit about this. We had a couple of episodes that people fucking hated. I mean,
was this the Thirsty Falls?
Oh, God, you named it. I think they're fine. But like, people fucking hated them. And the reason that they said they hated them was railroading. Mm-hmm. Right. I think it's bullshit. I think the real reason they didn't like those episodes is like the structure wasn't very tight. And people don't like stories with bad structure. It's just the way it goes.
Right.
But the only vocabulary they had to express, the only, like, you know, I don't like this. What word should I use to describe why? And you look at the pile of words, and there's a pile of words you use to describe Dungeons and Dragons podcast, and railroading is just right there on top. And so it's just the one that's just the closest, and we're going to use that. Yeah, and it's like, I fucking yell at me if you want, but like, at least you should be critiquing the art that you're talking about on the terms that the art is presented to you.
Yes.
Right. I shouldn't look at The Godfather and be like, I don't know. I only like things that are 7 hours long. What's like, OK,
right.
That's fine if you only like things that are 7 hours long. But this person set out to make a 3 hour movie.
It's like I work in television. I do a lot of food competition shows. And every time they do like the judging of the food, every now and then there'll be a judge who says like, well, we've got this beautiful plate in front of me, but I don't like papaya. So
yeah, well,
you don't
buddy.
Win. It's like, doesn't matter what you like. Like, you've got to judge the dish based on what was presented to you, not your preferences. Yeah. And you cannot like the dish. Absolutely. You cannot like the show. Absolutely. But to use the wrong vocabulary to do it is not helping anybody.
That being said, however, there is something to it. Whereas even in narrative play shows, because they're improvised, so improvisation, right? No matter how well edited you do it, there's always an aspect of it. A lot of the enjoyment of it is based on the audience being able to tell that the people doing it are interacting with each other genuinely.
Yes.
So what I mean to say is that, like, you can watch them be surprised by each other. That is almost impossible to replicate with like a play or a screenplay or anything like that.
Yeah.
Very, very difficult. One of the greatest, I think, compliments a writer can get is like, oh, was that improvised? Anytime you write dialogue, you want people to feel like that it was so organic and natural that it was being created on the spot.
It was just happening. The world was being created in front of them.
We love it. So even though we are trying to hit a narrative show and we're focusing on narrative, we still leave in some table talk and some conversation amongst the cast about what's going on, because you're really telling two stories. One is the story of the show, and the other is the story of the people making the show, making that show together.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's one of the great things about seeing live, good live improv, is that you're watching them watch themselves make it with you. And so you're really seeing two things. You're seeing the scene is presented, and you're seeing the people who are performing it experiencing with you for the first time.
Right.
But even if you look at like TV shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm, which a lot of scenes are improvised based on an outline, I think one of the reasons that it works and shows in TV like that work is that you can just subconsciously, you can tell that they're kind of being surprised at the other person genuinely. And so it activates a little bit of that second level storytelling you get from watching people improvise. So even at the far ass, far, far level of narrative play, you know, you can still hear people laugh at each other out of character.
Right. And it's because when there's those little breaks, when there's those little moments, you're not only enjoying the character that is being played, you're enjoying the person that is playing the character. And like, 100%. Why wouldn't you want to enjoy both of those things? Like, it's great to have both of those kind of highs of watching a piece of entertainment.
Absolutely. Yeah. It would be foolish, I think, to try and rid the show entirely of that.
Yeah. It would be all the poorer for it. Cause you like seeing the people figure, like, you like hearing the laugh of being surprised by the crazy thing a friend did. And then also having to hear what might be incongruous reaction from the character. Like, if I think a move is funny, but my character thinks it's bad, it's funny to see both of those things happen from the same mouth.
So I guess my first advice to someone looking to produce this sort of show is don't be a zealot. Don't be like, don't Lady Macbeth this thing and try to scrub out every single spot, right? Like, you got to leave in some of the dirt, or otherwise it doesn't feel human. I think the reason a lot of audio fiction has not caught on, and the reason a lot of chat shows have, is there's something about the intimacy of audio where we're, I don't know exactly what it is, but there's something about the intimacy of audio where we're more eager to welcome in just like people laughing and goofing around with us than like hardcore narrative of others, like the capital O other into our heads.
The way I've kind of thought about it is that it's so intimate because when you have headphones on, it kind of feels like it has the same sensation of the voice in your head, like the way you think, and no one thinks the way that that many narrative. I love a lot of narrative podcasts.
I think that's really smart. Yeah.
But when you just hear people talking and like chatting, that's how your voice sounds in your head. That's how the world sounds. When something gets too far removed from that, there's an incongruity that like doesn't, you can't relax into it in the same way you can relax into a good conversation.
Absolutely. And that reminds me of how film editors find that a lot of times when they are making a cut, that the characters on screen at that moment where the editor wants to cut, the actors are blinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because it's this like connection of the actors are responding to an emotional beat in that moment. And the editor is also responding to that sort of caesura of emotional momentum. At the same time, a good film edit job, the edits come at the time that feels subconsciously normal to your eye and to your brain.
Yeah.
It's just like watching the movie, there's no work. Like the edits come when you, the viewer, are blinking. And I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense with audio, that we want what we're listening to sort of match the reactive pattern of our brain, where, oh, we're laughing at that too. Or like, we're surprised at that too.
Yeah.
And the thing we're listening to is reacting to itself just like we might. I think that makes a lot of sense to me.
And I do want to say, there are some fiction podcasts I love that definitely don't have, like, I mean, if you listen to the Hitchhiker's Guide podcast, like, are you kidding me? The thing is amazing. If you listen to,
but they have not taken off like chat shows have.
No. Yeah. It's just a different thing. And I think, and that is another thing that kind of could come from this world. Like, you know, a fiction podcast is just one step removed from the far end of narrative play. And I think there is a world where that spectrum will just take off more as we like slowly better define this overly large category. And we start experimenting more and more and more in the way that Rude Tales, in the way that these, those stars, in the way that a lot of these types of shows are experimenting. And I think that's how we, you know, upgrade what was, you know, the classic genre of, you know, radio drama to something new that is consumed by a 21st century audience so used to a visual medium.
I think, and I really think that if the industry is able to successfully experiment with improvised fiction, that might be the way we do it.
Yeah.
But the industry is very hesitant to this because the industry is very much mired in, number one, the production process of hiring writers first.
Right.
They write it, then you produce it. They love that model. They love it. They love it because people with money don't trust anybody else, and they're in love with this idea of the writer, like this archetype of a writer. And everyone in radio thinks they're a writer. Like, you know, everyone wants to be that person banging away at the typewriter, you know. It's just that the image just, you know, it's very powerful. Whereas the improviser is God's fool, just like the absolute sucker of the 21st century media landscape. Unless you look at how many people have been, you know, made millionaires by the improv renaissance in TV.
I will say, And you'll think a little bit less of me, and some of the audience may as well. There was a time, especially when I first moved to New York, and I was seeing a lot of friends' improv shows, and they were like Improv 101, you know, in the back room of, you know, Legion Bar or something like that. Just the dirtiest little bar in all of Brooklyn.
Oh, I'm well aware of Legion, my friend.
I've got a real soft spot for Legion Bar, but man, it was a shitty little bar. I was fairly vocal about my idea that improv could not be better than sketch. Because sketch is just improv, but with time to think about it and make it better, which like I could still understand my logic. Essentially, it was like, hey, first drafts of anything aren't gold. It only becomes gold with editing and editing and editing. But that magic of great improv, that magic of seeing it happen in the moment as an audience member, giving yourself over to the world and like experiencing those characters have these crazy adventures, but also have that background knowledge of experiencing these people have these crazy adventures is something you just can't get from sketch, because it only gives you the one thing. It gives you the characters, which is why people so often love in like SNL sketches when people break. Like there's whole compilations on YouTube of, you know, Jimmy Fallon, because he laughs at everything, laughing at something. It's fun because you for a moment, you remember that there's a person there as well.
Yeah. And you're watching it with them and they're reacting in the way that you want to react. And then, yeah, there's this connection between the performer and the viewer that I think rules. And that's why that's the spark of improvisation provides that. And what actual play shows did, they were like, watch us use play by the rules. But what they were actually doing, the flubber they were accidentally creating was they were capturing this group of performers reacting to themselves as they were performing. And it was delightful.
Yeah.
You know, like,
who the fuck knew?
It's great.
That's it for part one of this interview with Taylor Moore. Next week, we will dive into some real-world production considerations that will be invaluable for anyone looking to start their very own narrative play show. Until then, please remember to check out the fantastic narrative play podcast from Fortunate Horse. Those are Rude Tales of Magic, Fun City, and Odes, Those Stars of Space. You can get them wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like them, please consider supporting them on Patreon to get extra episodes, talkbacks, and all kinds of great bonus content. You can find Taylor on Twitter at taylor.biz. That's TaylorDotBiz. And you can keep up with news on this show and all the others in the Fractured Realms on Twitter at 20SidedPod. That's TwentySidedPod. And remember, if you're having fun, you're already doing it right. See you next week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Hey, everybody, this is Abby. If you enjoyed this episode of My First Dungeon, you might want to check out some of our other shows in the Fractured Realms. For instance, our D&D actual play anthology show, The 20-Sided Podcast. This season is called Prisoners of the Static. And I play Natasha Borshekot, Captain of the Gilded Ghost. Interested? Check out the trailer and tune in every Monday for brand new episodes. Bye-bye!